You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 9th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
How many episodes have we done?
This is episode 866.
So this was the first episode in 860-some-odd that I've done where I was yawning right when you said, Bob.
It was bound to happen. Wasn't it bound to happen?
I did well. I think you couldn't even tell.
No, you recovered.
Oh, for 17 years? Plus years, Bob.
Bob, what skill?
You've come a long way since.
Didn't know I could do it.
But you broke your record, so you got to start your
count. Start one day without
yawning.
0 days without an accident.
So we are on the down slope of the Omicron surge. Numbers are plummeting.
I think get out of here, Omicron.
Yeah, they peaked at like 800,000 a day. Now they're down. New cases, 200,000. Hospitalizations are falling, which is like, you know, probably the most important thing.
Yeah.
Deaths always are a late sign. So they're just
the last to go.
Cresting, but yeah, they did surpass
900,000 deaths just in America.
Yeah, 910,000.
We're going to hit a million
in America, I think.
Yeah. Of course.
Just in the
U.S. Oh, my God. That's...
We are not, like, per capita, we're doing not well in this country compared to other, like, industrialized countries.
Nope.
No, not at all.
We have crested as well, I would say.
I read a couple of days ago, Steve, that we still have about 2,000 deaths a day. Have you read any stats like that?
Yeah, new daily reported deaths are still over 2,000.
Wow. Mm. That's still, you know, think about what we've gotten used to. I mean, it's horrifying.
I know.
Yeah. Yep.
Like, it just happens every day, and most of us aren't even thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. And in California, they've announced a few days ago that they're about to lift mask mandates. Same thing happened in New York, I think, just today or yesterday.
Yep. Yeah, Connecticut as well.
Illinois announced it as well. New Jersey, I believe, just announced it. So
I'm not ready.
But
I mean, I am.
Continue to wear your mask, then.
You can still wear your mask if you want.
I know. I'm not ready to be around other people not wearing masks. No,
I know. It's weird. I mean, I walk into my deli every, 5 days a week. I pop in, grab my sandwich, and pop out. I'm double masked because I got to get my sausage and egg sandwich. Nothing's going to stop that from happening. So I'm double masked, and most people that come in, no mask at all. And this is like Connecticut. I mean, where it's kind of, it's not
is
like
that legal. In California, you can't do that. You can't walk into a restaurant without a mask.
There is not a government mandate for masks
right now. I see. Okay. Right. So that's kind of personal choice. Yeah, in California,
not a state
you can't enter a public establishment without a mask. And in order to enter, or at least in Los Angeles, I don't know if this is statewide, but at least in Los Angeles, you can't dine in a restaurant without also showing your vaccine card because you're going to take your mask off.
Yeah, you have to take your mask off to eat.
Yeah. So it's one of those things where I'm of two minds about it. Like, I'm not ready because I'm paranoid and because I haven't gotten COVID. I'm like a unicorn and I don't want to.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't either, but I wouldn't describe myself as a unicorn, but I haven't either.
But also at the same time, Bob, like, I don't want to wear a mask forever. I'm over it. I feel like we're living in this super dystopian future where nothing's changing. Like, it feels like this is never going to end.
Well, I mean, it will end, and the way out of this is going to be through science and technology.
Yeah.
Of course.
There's a couple of things that I wanted to talk about. Researchers are developing a nasal spray COVID vaccine. So it's not a company yet. This is just sort of research. This is done in mice, not even in people yet. But the idea was they developed, very simple, it was a nasal spray that has the spike protein. That's it. Just the spike protein from the virus. No adjuvant, nothing else in there. It's just, all right, let's just spray spike protein in mouse's noses and see what happens. So they compared two groups. One group got one dose of an mRNA vaccine and then 2 weeks later got the nasal spray, and the other group just got the one dose of the vaccine. Then they exposed them to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. The group that had just the vaccine, not the nasal spray, 80% of the mice died. The group of mice that got both, well, they wanted to make, they wanted to have a high death rate because they needed to see what was happening.
So they exposed them to a lot of virus.
They gave them a high dose. Yeah.
Yeah.
mice catch COVID. I kind of didn't know that.
So did deer, by the way.
Deer.
Oh, yeah. I heard about the deer.
Now, the group that got the nasal spray in addition to the one dose, guess how many died? None.
Well, what happens?
That means nothing.
Did they not do a third where they just get the nasal spray?
Yeah.
No, because it's really designed to be a booster. It's not a vaccine, really. It's a nasal spray booster. And so that's what they were testing. Because I don't think
it would be interesting to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course.
And they may do that with later studies if it goes forward. But the idea is that the technique is called prime and spike. So first you prime the immune system with the dose of the vaccine, and then you give the spike protein into the respiratory tract, and that because the respiratory mucosa has its own antibodies. The IgA type antibodies, that's like a first line of defense of things getting into your body through your mucosa, your respiratory mucosa. And so the idea is you have systemic immunity with the vaccine, and then you'll have another layer of defense in your, the nose and your lungs through the nasal spray. And that approach seemed to work, at least in this, this mouse study.
But that's also how most people catch the virus. Like this is a respiratory virus.
Yeah. Yes. That's the point.
I mean, I'm sure you can still like lick the virus. I'm sure you can still you can get it other ways, but it does seem like it would almost, I don't know, it'd be interesting to compare it to the main immunity from just the vaccine.
They only gave one dose, not two, and they probably gave them a high inoculum, to really give them a high exposure. So if this develops into a full strategy, I don't think they would replace the second dose or even the booster shot, but just as an additional layer of defense, the higher we can push the effectiveness of the whatever vaccine strategy we come up with, the better.
The less chance of a variant.
If we can go from 85% to 90% to 98%, 99% because we have multiple layers,
now you're talking.
Something like that, then that could really go a long way to tamping down this pandemic even more. Of course, we need to get the number of people getting anything, up, getting any vaccines up. But
well, yeah, and that's the thing. Like nasal vaccines, or in this case, nasal boosters or nasal adjuvant kind of therapies, they are so much easier to administer. Like you don't need skilled technicians. I'd be interested to see if, you do it at home. I wonder if this can be kept at room temperature. Like this could be a game changer globally.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's definitely a worthwhile research line. The other thing I wanted to mention, we talked about the combination flu and COVID booster. I think we mentioned that Pfizer is developing one. Moderna also announced they're developing one. And it's also, they said it's going to be, it's about to start trials with an Omicron version of their vaccine. And they're developing the combination flu COVID vaccine, which they said by 2024. So that's not going to be for a while. Yeah. But that may be fine. I mean, once we get to the point where we are in maintenance mode, like the pandemic is basically down to background levels where it's endemic, it's not going to go away, of course, but it's like a bad version of the flu that's just going to be there. And we're going to get our every 6 month or every 1 year vaccine. At this point, I'm just hoping it's annual. But combining it with the flu, that could be one jab instead of two. Might be easier to get compliance up. And then have the other layer of some kind of nasal spray booster, really have super immunity. That could be, really effective. And then that's when you go about your normal life. Because if you get it, it's like, you got a cold. Like we didn't have masks and distancing, and everyone got sick two or three times a year with their colds and flus and stuff. You got your vaccine and you just accept that you're going to get sick a couple times a year. And this will just be one more type of virus that's going to make you sick if you are protective. Because the other thing is if you do get sick, it's going to be minor, at least chances are.
Yeah, if you're vaccinated.
If you're vaccinated, you probably won't get to go into a hospital or die from it. But COVID's still a nastier virus than the flu. That's the only thing is that the more we study it and the long COVID is like, there's a lot of long-term symptoms. The more you look for them, the more you find them. And it really shouldn't be thought of as a benign virus.
No. But we also are developing more and better treatments, not just preventive measures, but more and better treatments for COVID as well, right?
Yeah.
Because I know we mentioned once ages ago, I said something about Tamiflu and a bunch of people reached out and they're like, Tamiflu sucks. And I was like, I didn't really realize that there's kind of nothing you can do for the flu except hydrate, supportive care. Like, there's not a lot of treatment available if you have
the flu, just sucks for a week or so. Yeah.
Yeah, it just sucks. And you have to hope that you don't have something underlying and that you don't get so sick that it turns into something else and you die.
That's why I got my flu vaccine. It's a lot better than suffering with the flu. I've had the flu before. It's really terrible. Mm-hmm. Okay, Evan.
Yes.
I believe this is the second time you're doing this, the Name That Quote segment.
That's right. Name That Quote, also known as Quotation Rotation.
Okay, that's the official name?
Well, I'm also playing with Quotation Sensation, Quotation Nation,
Quotidian.
You know, anything with the, but I like Quotation Rotation, so I'm going to work with that for the
All
moment.
All right, that's your working title.
And if you recall, this is a game that we're going to play in which I'm going to give you a quote, and each of you, each of the four of you, are going to say where you heard it from or who you think said it. We have a theme for this one, and the theme is movies.
Ah.
So all of these quotes came from movies that I think you've all seen. We're about to find out. And it's multiple choice, which is nice. So you just don't have
thank
to, you know.
You.
Yes, absolutely. A, B, and C. All right. We've got five of these. Let's get through them. First one. Here's the first quote. Luckily, in the history of humanity, nothing bad has ever happened from lighting hydrogen on fire. Your choices are A, Contact, B, The Martian, C, Ad Astra. Bob, we'll start with you.
Not the Hindenburg movie? Shit. oh, boy. Let's say Ad Astra.
Bob says Ad Astra. Okay. Jay?
I'm going to say The Martian.
Kara?
I said The Martian in my head before you gave us the option, so I'm going to have to stick with that.
And Steve?
Yeah, I didn't say Ad Astra, but that does sound, I do remember the quote, so it has to be from one of the ones I've seen, and it sounds like the kind of snark I remember from The Martian, so I'll go with The Martian as well.
Yeah, me Martian too. Yeah, me too.
Bob's going to change his answer if he could to The Martian, and the answer is B, The Martian.
Yeah. Yes.
Mark Watney. It's from the scene where he had to, make water.
Make water.
Yeah, right.
Yep, and he goes through the whole process. It's nice. He gives you a little chemical analysis on how it all works and wraps it up by saying, and then if I just direct the hydrogen to a small area and burn it. Luckily, in the history of humanity, nothing bad has ever happened from lighting hydrogen on fire. And boom, goes up in flames.
I really recommend that book, Unabridged on Audio. It's wonderful.
Next quote. Here we go. Every time we have a chance to get ahead, they move the finish line. Was that from A, The Right Stuff, B, Tucker, A Man and His Dreams, or C, Hidden Figures? Now we're going to start with Jay.
I'm definitely going to go with the first one.
The Right Stuff? Yeah. Jay says The Right Stuff. Okay, Kara?
I've only seen Hidden Figures out of those three, but I think it is Hidden Figures. It sounds like they're talking about, moving the goalposts.
Steve?
Yeah, I was thinking either Hidden Figures or the Tucker one, because that is I did that is a lot of I'll just to be different from Kara, I'll say Tucker.
Okay, Tucker and Bob.
I'm going to say Hidden Figures. Great movie, and this totally fits that movie. I don't specifically remember that quote, but it makes sense.
And the correct answer is C, Hidden Figures.
Yes.
Yeah, high five.
Every time we have a chance to get ahead, they move the finish line. Let me see if I can tell you in what context it was happening. It was a conversation between Vivian Mitchell, who was one of the employees at NASA, and Mary Jackson, who actually said the character Mary Jackson, who said the quote, the person Mary Jackson, I should say, and which they're exchanging, a conversation about female engineers in the engineering training program. And Vivian says, we require advanced extension courses through the University of Virginia, in which, of course, black women could not attend to take those classes. And then Mary Jackson, every time we have a chance to get ahead, they move the finish line. Indeed. All right. Third quote. Here we go. We've always defined ourselves by the ability to overcome the impossible. Is that from A, Interstellar, B, 2001, A Space Odyssey, C, Gravity? All right, Kara, we'll start with you.
I never saw Interstellar. I think it's probably Gravity. It could have been Interstellar, but I don't know. Some shit goes down in Gravity, so I'm going to say it's Gravity.
Is there a reason you didn't see Interstellar?
I just never got around to it. I heard such good things about the science, that like Kip Thorne and, all these great people were consulting, but then I heard it wasn't that good a movie.
It was okay.
Yeah. So, and you know, I don't love sci-fi, but if it like, if it grabs me, it grabs me. But yeah, just never got around to seeing it. So I'll go with Gravity.
Directed by Christopher Nolan too. Okay. So you're saying Gravity. Steve.
Yeah, I'll say Gravity as well. It's definitely not 2001. I mean, I saw that movie so many times, I don't remember that quote. And there's so little dialogue.
Who's we? Exactly.
There's so little dialogue in that movie. Like, you would kind of remember every line. No, I'll say Gravity.
Bob?
Yeah, I think Gravity as well.
And Jay?
Gravity.
We have everybody in agreement that it is Gravity. The answer is A, Interstellar.
Ah, crap.
Wow. Nice.
Don't you love it?
I do love it because that means I'm still ahead.
That's right. Yep, so far. Let's see. Kara, you've gotten two correct. Steve's gotten, one correct? Jay's got one. Bob's got one. All right. Two more. We'll see if we can break up this log jam. Here we go. The fourth one. Advice about keeping secrets. It's a lot easier if you don't know them in the first place. Is that from A, A Beautiful Mind? B, The Manhattan Project? C, The Imitation Game? All right, Steve, we'll start with you.
I don't recognize that quote, but I'll say The Imitation Game.
And we move on to Bob.
Yeah, Imitation Game, I think. Makes sense, okay. I think. It just popped in my head. Imitation Game.
Jay?
This is a really hard one. I mean, I'm just going to go with these guys.
Okay. And Kara.
That was my original instinct, too, and I'm probably screwing myself here and leveling the playing field out, but I think I'm going to go with The Manhattan Project. I can imagine a time when somebody would ask somebody something. And they were like, listen, I'm not going to tell you, because if you don't know, you won't have to keep it as a secret.
That's interesting, Kara, because you have two correct. Everyone else has one correct. So if you're wrong and if the guys are right, that means it's a 2-2 tie from everyone. Going into the last question, the answer is C, The Imitation.
Dang.
Yep.
Right. Who was he? Or what was he?
All right, folks, last one. This will be it. Here we go. Perverted scientists who advance an insidious theory called evolution. Is that from the movie A, Creation? B, Inherit the Wind? C, Planet of the Apes? And we will start with Bob.
It'd be Inherit and Creation. I have no idea what the hell that is.
I don't know what Inherit the Wind is.
What? Inherit the Scopes Trial, baby.
Yeah, the monkey Scopes Trial.
Oh, no way. Oh, okay.
And Creation was a movie starring Paul Bettany as Darwin.
Damn, now I want to watch that.
Yeah.
All right, I'll say Creation.
Okay, Bob says Creation. Jay?
That would be Planet of the Apes.
Interesting. What? Kara?
No, I want to go last.
Hey, suck it up. I went first twice.
I'll go Inherit the Wind. I never saw it.
Oh, wow. We have a split. All right, Steve, break the tie.
I really think this is Planet of the Apes.
No way!
Seriously?
And the answer is C, Planet of the Apes.
No way!
Yes, it is.
Jay, congratulations.
Jay and Steve, well done.
I knew it for certain. I absolutely
really.
You sounded from the, like you
from
knew
the
for
court
certain.
From the courtroom scene. In which
the courtroom scene. I was like 90%.
Wow! It's been too long. That means it's been too long since I've watched it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's been forever. Because you're talking about the original Planet of the Apes.
1968.
Yeah.
Charlton Heston. Great movie. Great
the
movie.
The Planet of the Apes. Mm-hmm. That's the only one I can recommend. I can't recommend a single other.
The plan.
So good job, guys. It was very close. Jay and Steve, you guys pulled it out in the end. Well done. Well done. Thanks for playing Quotation Rotation.
Good
this
job.
Was fun.
Good job, man.
Yep. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
All right, let's dig into the news items. Have you guys seen the headlines about a new treatment for spinal cord injury that allows people to walk and have children?
Yes.
Who hasn't? It's everywhere.
I know. I had to talk about this because it is everywhere. But, it, you know, the reporting is so bad.
Miraculously.
Of course. Right.
So it's not true?
Even the BBC, which is, I know it's not beyond reproach, but it's usually like a decent, you know, news outlet. It's not trash. Really got this wrong. I mean, not the details are fine, but the hyping this as a breakthrough, first of its kind, blah, 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 is nonsense. It just has nothing to do. This is a classic example of taking an incremental advance and turning it into a breakthrough. Classic. So you know, the reporting, they say, like, the headline is paralyzed man with severed spine walks thanks to implant.
Steve, you corrected it with the title of your blog post, Incremental Advance Treating Spinal Cord Injury. So thank you
deliberate.
For that.
We, it was
but
deliberate.
Steve, I was reading, I read your blog. It was really good. But man, Incremental Advance Treating Spinal Cord Injury. You know, I mean, it's so hard on science popularizers, right? Because it's like, you got to go with lines like that. You can't throw out there, you know, like the BBC News, paralyzed man walks. But you, Steve, couldn't you have spiced it up a bit? Like, couldn't you have said something like, wonderfully incremental advanced treating spinal cord injury?
Or, I hear you, Bob, but it was deliberate because I wanted to have a stark contrast to the mainstream reporting.
Okay. Well, you didn't have to go with boring. How about this? Vastly more interesting incremental advance than the previous incremental advance. That would have been good. I don't know. It's tough.
I don't think it's true. All right. So let me tell you what the actual advance was. What they're doing is treating people who have like a crush injury of their spinal cord.
Oof.
Who are completely paralyzed. So they have no motor or sensory function below the damage, below the lesion, right? Complete, like no sensation or movement in their legs. And then they implant stimulators. And it's interesting. They plant the stimulators on the dorsal roots, which are the sensory roots. Why would they be doing that, you might ask? Why aren't they stimulating the motor roots, right? The whole point here is to get the legs to move. Because when you stimulate the dorsal roots, that stimulation gets into the spinal cord and then activates the motor neurons in the spinal cord. And it's just a way of stimulating an ensemble of motor units that you could then control to create a specific effect like walking. Whereas if you stimulated the motor root, the whole leg would just twitch, right? It wouldn't replicate a walking maneuver. So it's like you're going in through the back door because it gives you better control, essentially, over which muscles are contracting and what pattern. And of course, they use computers to help, you know, control which muscles contract. They also use some stimulation which keeps the signal from spreading to the other side. You know what I mean? Like it runs interference. So they're kind of corralling the electricity so it's only stimulating the muscles they want it to. And then with this external stimulation, right?
Mm-hmm.
They, with an external controller, which could be built into a walker, for example, you then will go through the sequence of artificially stimulating the legs so that you could walk, right? That's the technology. This technology has been around for decades. That basic technology, what I just described for you.
So okay. What's new?
What's new? I'll tell you what's new. The electrodes that we normally use for this kind of technology are repurposed electrodes designed to stimulate the dorsal root ganglia to treat pain, right? So we took these dorsal root ganglia pad electrodes and just repurposed them to create this electronic stimulation to create walking in people who have spinal cord injury. The advance was they made slightly better electrodes. That's it. They made custom electrodes that are, you know, that are able to be positioned better because they're not repurposed electrodes from another function. They're made specifically for this. So they're a little bit longer. You know, they can reach, you know, a wider range of segments and get better into position. That's the entire advance, slightly better electrodes.
So did slightly better electrodes equal extremely better outcomes or
no,
just slightly better outcomes?
Slightly better outcomes.
Okay. Incremental.
Incremental, slightly better outcomes because they still like can't like walk every day. You know, it still takes a lot of effort and training to be able to walk. They were able to train them more quickly. It was more natural. It's still a huge effort. It's still just a proof of concept, really. And it's mainly to help them move, help them get physical therapy, help keep them more physically fit because they're moving more. But it really isn't to like enable them to walk normally, you know.
Is like to prevent muscle atrophy.
Yeah, disuse atrophy, and also it helps with their blood pressure and things like that. If you're sitting with paralyzed legs all day, it's not good for you. So that's it. It's the same basic technology with slightly better electrodes. And they parlayed that into like this massive breakthrough. Again, I'm not downplaying this research or these advances are important. They did find something else that was very interesting. They found that So again, these are people who have completed three patients. That was the study, three subjects. They had complete paralysis, but their spinal cord was not completely severed. And what they found was that after using the stimulation for a while, that they were able to like slightly modulate the way their legs moved, which seemed to imply that there was like some voluntary control of their muscle movements. And then they found when they studied it that there was some activity getting through, like getting across the injury. So what they think was happening was that you had some intact neurons, some intact nerves, like that were survived, that were getting through the injury point, but that they were basically not functioning. They were asleep because they were never being recruited. They weren't being used. But the stimulation sort of woke them up and got them to function.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So you had even without the stimulation, like they were able to do a little bit of movement. So they went from zero movement to a tiny bit of movement. And this could be functionally significant, you know, if they're able to control the way their legs are moving, even a tiny bit, that might
help exercise them, rehab, yeah,
might help them walk with the stimulator better than if they had zero movement.
But sadly, this is not some sort of new hope for people who have a total spinal cord injury. Like if it's completely ablated, there's nothing they're going to regain.
No. So the BBC reporting got a lot of things wrong and even contradicted themselves. So first of all, they said that the spinal cord was completely severed. No, right. By definition, it wasn't.
It's a crushing injury. It's not a lightsaber injury.
Because by definition, there were some neurons that were surviving across the gap. If it was severed, that wouldn't be the case. They also said that it was boosting the signal across the spinal cord. It's like, well, you know, that only applied to this epiphenomenon of waking up a few of those neurons. It does not how the technology works. It works by you pushing a button to stimulate the spinal cord distal to the injury to just artificially stimulate and move the muscle. So they kind of got that wrong as well. So it just gave a really completely different impression of what was going on. They also made it sound like one of the patients was able to have a child. Has nothing to do with the reestablishment of any kind of neurological function. Like you might say, oh, like a paralyzed guy who couldn't have kids because he was paralyzed, like, you know, his reproductive organ isn't working, and now it is working enough that he can't have a kid, right? That's kind of the impression you get when you read it enables him to have a child. Yeah, that's not what happened at all. It was just that because he was able to work out with this stimulator, it helped his blood pressure, it made him more active, he had more energy, and that enabled him to have the energy to raise a kid. That's it.
But that's insane.
It's like, yeah.
I mean, they say that. They kind of.
I know, it's terrible science reporting. Terrible.
And how deliberate is that misdirection?
I mean, I think it's half and half. I think they're trying to juice this up as much as possible, and they think the other half is they just misunderstood certain aspects of the science. Of course, I read the original study, you know, read the whole thing.
Well, so should the science report. Like, that's the problem with getting rid of all of your science reporters and only having general assignment reporters doing this kind of work. Like,
totally.
They just may not understand the science.
Yeah, like, not understanding that you can't have a signal getting across if it was completely severed. Like, that's a direct contradiction to that. So that means you don't understand something here, so you better go back to the drawing board and find out what's going on. But this
did
just,
the BBC not did the BBC not contact specialists to give them the real information?
They did. Like, they did, but that doesn't mean anything. If you have a reporter interviewing a scientist, what questions do they ask? How do you know? You can ask leading questions. You can take their answers out of context. Scientists complain about that all the time. It's like, that's not what I said, you know. So they interviewed the scientists and they have lots of quotes there. But if you read the quotes, like what the actual quote is saying, like they have done something that has not been done before. It's like, okay, that's true. It's also pretty vague, but you could make it sound like it's something that it isn't, you know.
Right.
So when it was stimulated, did they have an experience of feeling or not?
No.
Okay.
No. Because remember, you're stimulating below the injury. So that's a good way to stimulate the motor function. Because remember, in terms of the anatomy of the spinal cord, you have the motor cells, right? You have the cell is in the spinal cord itself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. and so the cell is alive and its axon goes down the spinal cord out into the muscle. So if there's an injury above that nerve, it doesn't affect that nerve, that cell body or the nerve itself. It's still intact, right?
Unless it gets disused.
Well, then you get disuse atrophy. Yeah, you don't get denervation atrophy. Like if you destroy that neuron, then you get much worse atrophy. What does happen is you don't normally the neurons above it that have been severed or that are not working, they inhibit the tone in those motor neurons. And so when you get spasticity, right? Mm-hmm. So that's a problem. This doesn't fix the spasticity. That has to be treated otherwise. But the sensory nerves are going in the other direction. So stimulating below the lesion doesn't get you anything across the lesion going up. But you're bypassing the lesion when you're stimulating going down to the motor pathway.
Right. Does that make sense? I wasn't sure. Yeah, I just wasn't sure if then there was some sort of feedback from the motor. So you're stimulating the sensory portion. It sends that signal down. You get this like motor contraction. And then does the motor contraction then send any sort of feedback back up?
It does. But there are feedback that will sort of like reflexes in the spinal cord itself. They won't perceive it in the brain because those signals are not getting up to the brain.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That must be so hard then, because then you're you're walking again, like you said, like kind of clumsily and like, you know, with a lot of purpose, or you're moving in such a way that's like with OT, PT people helping you, but you're not feeling what's happening.
Yeah.
That would be really difficult.
Yeah, so they did say like, oh, this isn't a cure for spinal cord injury, and that's true. It's not a cure. It's you can just bypassing it for the motor function, and it's kind of clunky, but it can allow people to walk, you know, like again with like a walker where they hit the buttons to stimulate their muscles to walk. It really should be looked at as a rehab tool and sort of a health tool, but not a fixing the problem with the spinal cord injury tool. I don't know if this kind of thing is even on that pathway, you know, even when this technology is mature, what it would really look like. Because again, it doesn't really fix the sensory problem, and there's going to be inherent limits to how well you're going to be able to control those muscles. I guess, you know, the super mature version of this would be like you're wearing robotic limbs, like right. that are in your legs, and a computer is entirely controlling them and making them walk in a natural way. And you know that could give a measure of independence, but again, it would be weird because you'd be walking on these legs you can't feel.
You can't feel, and you also are you lacking proprioception in a spinal cord injury too? Yeah, that's what I figured. So you'd have to look at your feet.
And if you look at the video, they are looking at their feet.
Yeah,
you
know? That's the only way.
Yeah, so the better approach is to repair the cord itself. You know, get those nerves to regrow. Although you could use a combination, right? A hybrid, Jay. You could get, if you get any neurons, like maybe there are some neurons in there that could be coaxed back to life, or you might get a few of them to be able to grow across the gap. If you could restore 10 or 20% of the function just biologically with regeneration, then it becomes easier to augment that function with this kind of external stimulation or robotics or whatever. So that may be where things are headed in this medium term until we could like fully repair spinal cords or like have fully robotic limbs or something. So again, this is one little baby step on a very complicated long road that we're taking
incremental.
Here. But it's still nice. It's still good. But really, the actual innovation was they designed slightly better electrodes.
Which has been a limiting factor. We do talk about that a lot. We need better electrodes.
But it's not a new approach to the electrodes. It's not like a new way in or a new electrode technology. It's just instead of repurposed, they were custom. That was it. So they were slightly longer, you know, whatever. That was it. It's like,
so it's kind of low-hanging fruit then.
Yeah, right. Totally. Like, why did like they do this 10 years ago? It was just a money thing. It's like we have these electrodes, but we'll repurpose them. They said, let's just make special electrodes to see if that works better. Oh, it does work a little better. Okay, great. That's the whole thing.
Call the presses.
Light up the internet.
Halt the presses, whatever that's.
So it's exciting and frustrating at the same time. And I don't want to downplay this research or what this means to patients, getting any function back, being able to like stand up and walk, even with a walker, get your legs to move again. It's all huge.
But we
got to put it into the context of what's actually happening here. And this creates a false impression that we're right around the corner to solving spinal cord injuries.
Yep. Yeah.
Imagine if you had a spinal cord injury and you read this and you got a totally wrong impression, then someone's going to have to let you down.
Yeah, you know, when the emotional impact can be severe.
Anyway, all right, Jay, you're going to tell us about a real breakthrough, a new artificial enamel.
Well, I think my news item's a little bit cooler than yours, Steve.
All right. All right.
Okay. I know you like teeth, Jay, right?
Yeah. I mean, I like the benefit of dentistry. If you let dentistry wash over you, it does so many good things. Could you imagine not having modern dentistry? Just think about that for a minute.
Oh, I just had my cleaning the other day. It felt so good.
But, you know, this missing teeth, imagine having massive, like, you know, holes in your teeth. I mean, come on. You got to just lay down and say modern dentistry is one of the examples of science, you know, with amazing effect.
Amen. And like every movie is anachronistic about that. Like every single movie from prehistory or even from early human history, people have good teeth. And that wouldn't have been the case, would it?
I like seeing movies and shows where they gnarl up the people's teeth from 1780 because that's the way it was.
But they still show them making out. Ew.
Yeah, well, you're right, Kara. You're right.
You know.
Yeah, you bad know? Teeth still porn is not fun.
No.
Still got to procreate. You know?
All right, let's go over some basics here, guys. Let's go over some basics. Enamel is the hardest substance made by the human body.
Is that right?
Yeah. And what does it do? It protects your teeth. It protects them from acid and decay and general wear and tear. And the cool thing about it is that it's incredibly durable, and also it's elastic enough to not crack.
By cracking?
Which is very important. Yeah. It's very important, and you should remember that during the course of this news item. So unfortunately, once our bodies make a tooth's enamel, and that tooth comes out, the cells die that make enamel. Once, I guess pretty much when they hit the open air, that's when they die. So they can't survive and continue to do what they do. Of course, scientists have been trying to make something as strong as enamel for tooth repair, but historically this has proven to be very hard. Until recently. There's been a breakthrough, Kara. But before I get to that, let's just talk further about enamel. Let me explain to you some of the complexity here. The reason it's been hard to recreate enamel is that it's a very, very complicated structure. First, oxygen, phosphorus, and calcium atoms are joined in a weave-like pattern, which is complicated. This forms crystalline wires made of hydroxyapatite. Then a magnesium coating. Remember the magnesium. This magnesium coating goes around the wires, and those wires again weave together to form a very durable material that again is organized into yet another set of groups that twist. Right? It's very, very complicated.
Wow.
It's been compared to saying, like, you take cotton, you spin it into cotton thread, then you weave that into like a more complicated cotton thread that then gets combined with many other cotton threads to become something complicated. Do you get what I'm saying?
Like
this is how complex it is. Yeah, but you know, it's the compounding of the complexity.
It's the weirdest metaphor I've ever heard.
It's not a good metaphor.
No, that was good. That was good.
No, I liked it.
So this is the reason why researchers have failed to create true enamel. They've used peptides in the past, which are short chains of amino acids, and those peptides were used to organize the wires that they can create. It's at this stage where they couldn't really achieve the complexity needed to be hard, elastic, stiff. This is something called viscoelasticity, strength, toughness. You know, these are all ways that we measure how strong something is. And it also has to have significant damage resistance. And keep in mind, this is only something that's several millimeters thick. Think about how powerful that this substance is. It stays on your teeth. If you take care of them, it could stay on your teeth for your entire life and protect them for your entire life. That's a very, very durable substance.
Yeah, until you don't brush your teeth and little bacteria say, I'm going to mess with this.
I'm going to eat it. Yeah, they eat it. So in this recent achievement that scientists have had, they are able to create a synthetic material that mimics this biochemical process, right? Because look at that whole thing that I told you as one complicated biochemical process. The scientists create the crystalline wires, like I mentioned before, but now they use a metal-based coating made of zirconium. This is zirconium oxide, and this is used instead of the magnesium that your body uses. So they actually pick something that's more durable than what our body uses, which is magnesium, and they shift it over to zirconium oxide, a better material. It's actually stronger, and the enamel that is created with this process is stronger than normal natural enamel. And of course, it is still non-toxic. It's stronger, guys. It's a better material.
But would it give you silver teeth like Jaws on James Bond movie?
I guess if they suspend silver nanoparticles in there, I don't see why not. It couldn't be silver, but they didn't do that
yet.
So they use a diamond blade saw to cut the material into the shape that they need, right? Because I guess
diamonds are hard.
It's not like a liquid. They can't paint it on or spray it on to the surface of your teeth.
From my understanding, Kara, I don't want to say they grow it, but kind of, through a chemical process, they're manufacturing it, they're growing it. I don't think they have crazy control over its shape, which could be problematic. Now, the artificial tooth enamel. This gets very complicated here, but they use an AIP-coated hydroxyapatite nanowires, right? This is what I said before, but with much more science in there, which they say they're aligned using dual-directional freezing, right? It's definitely a temperature-treating situation in the presence of polyvinyl alcohol. And
wait, so the doctor gets drunk before he puts it on your teeth?
But they're talking about things on the atomic and nano scale that they're growing and creating here. So they did not need to, though, guys, weave the new enamel into the incredibly intricate 3D structure, as I described, natural enamel has. They didn't have to go that far. They assembled the nanowires as parallel wires, and they still were stronger. They still were a stronger matrix. So when they measure the elasticity and hardness of new enamel that they're creating, they put a tiny cut into it, right? So they get down there with that diamond tool, and they put this little cut in there, and then they press down really hard on that cut until it cracks. And the amount of force that they use and the size of the crack is how that they measure how strong and resistant this new enamel is. They also test how much force it is needed to put a dent in it using the diamond tip tool, and that's another way that they measure how strong it is. The new enamel was able to function better than natural enamel in the previous six ways that I listed. Remember I said its hardness, how elastic it is, how stiff it is, viscoelasticity, strength, toughness, and damage resistance. So they're measuring it in all those different ways, and it beats them all. It beats natural enamel by all those ways. The research team is now figuring out how to bond this material to natural enamel. That's really the next big step that they need to do. And this might help them figure out how to shape it, Kara. I would love to see, video imagery of what's going on and the growing process and how they're doing it. I couldn't find anything, unfortunately. Now, guys, outside of this, they're also talking about using the material.
Yeah, for what?
To coat electronics,
vest?
Making electronics super durable, say for outer space, or just to normal wear and tear. Like you'd be able to drop electronics, and they're saying that the enamel could support the material and help the electronics not break like they normally would.
Yeah, but would you have to floss it occasionally?
Of course. It's, and then they were
use that fluoride mouthwash.
Yeah, you're gonna have to hose down your building that's made out of this stuff with it. Yeah, but they were saying that they could even use it for building materials. Now imagine that, like enamel as a building material. They could make enough of it where it's not like this thin coating.
It's hard.
Yeah. So I'm very jazzed about this. I think it's really. I just can't wait. Imagine you go into the dentist and they're like, would you like us to coat your teeth with new enamel? We're like, yes, of course I would.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I would love that.
Oh, me too.
Oh my gosh.
Me too.
Yeah, I've got these tiny little pockets near where my gum line is, and I know some of the enamel has rubbed away over the years.
Well, Evan, when you have any type of receding gum situation, there isn't enamel down there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
once it goes
right,
low
Jay.
Enough. So, they could put, the new enamel on there. Bob could have silver-coated enamel,
I just don't want, I have so many freaking cavities in my mouth. I mean, fillings, they're all filled. But, my teeth are so sensitive to cold, and they're so sensitive to sugar, and they're so sensitive to everything. I just don't want sensitive teeth anymore.
Yeah, I'm sure this would be able to fix that.
Probably.
I wonder if they would, if they were doing a cavity, filling a cavity, would they just, lay that inside? The cavity instead of anything else?
Can it be used as a filling?
Probably. Yeah. And probably because even now when they put the composite, let's say you have a cavity in the chewing surface of your teeth, not like on the side in between your teeth, they'll usually drill out, get all of the decay, fill it with the composite, and then lay a little bit of additional on top of the chewing surface of your teeth.
Right. Yeah.
Just to kind of provide some additional, structure. So why not? I mean, this would be like sealants. You guys remember getting sealants when we were kids?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Just like seal all your teeth.
Yep, that'll be cool. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Bombas Socks.
Guys, in case you forgot, Bombas' mission is simple. Make the most comfortable clothes ever and match every item sold with an equal item donated. So when you buy Bombas, you're also giving to someone in need.
Yeah, don't forget, they don't just make socks. They make shirts. They make underwear. All of their materials are made out of soft merino wool or Pima cotton, even cashmere. And everything Bombas makes, you know, it's soft. There's no seams, so it doesn't, that wouldn't bother you. There's no tags, because that could bother you, but they're not there. And they have a luxuriously cozy feel, good for Kara.
Absolutely. They have so many different styles, too. There's a pair of Bombas socks for literally everything that you do, any activity you might have. My favorite are the little ankle socks because they have this reinforced toe. They have all this really yummy arch support, just squeezes your foot really well. They come in a ton of different colors. And yeah, my sock drawer is just full of them. I love them.
Go to bombas.com/skeptics and get 20% off any purchase. That's BOMBAS.com/skeptics for 20% off.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Bob, so when I read this news item that you're going to talk about, I was like, dang, is our book already obsolete before it came out?
Oh, boy. Yeah, we'll have to talk about this after the show. But in 2018, NASA sent out a challenge for engineers to propose a method to get to Mars in 45 days or less with a payload of 1,000 kilograms, over a ton. And... yeah. Nobody came up with anything.
Because it's impossible.
I'm done. Oh, wait, this just in. Wait, so McGill University came up with a proposal using lasers, and I totally loved it. It just kept, the more research I did and the more I took notes on it, I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. So NASA's challenge makes sense, of course, to me, I think. Primarily, I think, because getting people to Mars while minimizing exposure to galactic cosmic rays and solar storms is really a grand challenge for crewed space travel. It really is. It's like one of those proverbial holy grails at this point. And because think about it, shielding is the obvious solution, right? Yeah, just throw some shields all over, you know, the ship and you're good. But no, that is disappointingly not a realistic short-term goal or an easy goal at all. That's really difficult and we're just not ready to do that. The cost right now to lift all that material needed for proper shielding is just too high. It's just too expensive. And creative cheap solutions are just not going to happen near term.
That's
I mean, just ask a space scientist. And we have the viable options now are essentially these. Get there as fast as you can and learn ways to deal with any radiation damage after it happens.
Oh,
that's it.
Tardigrade proteins.
Right, Steve, right? Isn't that what
that's was it? It said get there fast.
Get there fast.
There is no shielding. There's no shielding solution anytime in the foreseeable.
It's like having to cross the hot coals. Just run over them as fast as you can. Minimize the burn.
Mm-hmm. Well, not hot coals. Maybe hot steel, but not hot coals because you can safely do that.
For a certain.
All right.
Yeah, we'll get it off.
So considering what the space scientists say, so nuclear-based rockets are a no-brainer. Duh, right? That they're fantastic. I've been talking about them for decades. With them, you can get there in half the time of chemical rockets, say maybe 100 days to Mars. And that's great. I mean, that's great. That's better than, you know, 6 months, 7 months. That's wonderful. But so the McGill engineers, though, came up with an idea that's even faster. They're saying 45 days. And that's because it partially or mostly obviates the tyranny of the rocket equation, which we've talked about, and that basically means that conventional chemical rockets will absolutely, truly, and will forever totally suck. That's kind of the rocket equation, my way of saying, you know, explaining the rocket equation. So that strategy offers just fundamental and huge limitations that can never compare to other strategies where you don't carry all your fuel and power creation on board. So McGill engineers propose a laser thermal rocket, which is what they're proposing, for the trip from Earth orbit or, you know, cislunar space between the Earth and Moon to Mars. So you're not going to be using laser thermal rockets to launch from the Earth. That's not going to happen. Not near term anyway. There may be, you know, a method or two to get off of the Earth without using chemical rockets quickly. But they're not talking about this. You're gonna get your payload into orbit somewhere, and then you're gonna use the laser thermal rocket propulsion that they're talking about. So that's an important caveat to understand. So all right. So this uses a powerful laser to heat a liquid like hydrogen turning it into propellant that exits from a nozzle, okay? So you still need the hydrogen as reaction mass, so you're not completely doing away with the rocket equation, because you still have some you still have this propellant mass on board. But remember, all the complexity and weight of the power source is now outside the ship, and that is absolutely critical for this. Absolutely critical. So the result then is this, is the following. You half the mass of the propellant that a conventional chemical rocket would use is not needed now, because the external power source could be far greater than what pure combustion on board would provide. Saving half the chemical rocket fuel, that's huge. And this can bring the trip to Mars down to 45 days, as I've said, which is astonishingly quick. That is amazingly fast. And it also means that the cargo can move from a few percent of the weight for that's typical of a chemical rocket, up to many times that for laser thermal rockets. So your payload goes way, way up, and it's not just like it's mostly fuel and just a tiny little speck of cargo. It's many, many times that. Many, many specks, I guess. There's also less chance of an explosion, which is nice, and there's no need to drop chunks of yourself off as you're rocketing away, so that's good. But those are just the, you know, the superficial qualities here. Now, if you drill down a little bit more, it's really fascinating. So they envision an array of infrared lasers on Earth about 10 meters wide, producing 100 megawatts. You may be saying, well, wait, why are you shooting a laser from the Earth? That you're going through the atmosphere. That's not a great idea. Well, it's actually not that much of a problem because you know, you've heard of adaptive optics for telescopes. Basically, adaptive optics means that you're changing the the material that's in your telescope really fast to adapt to what the atmosphere is doing. So essentially, it makes the atmosphere like kind of like invisible, where it just compensates essentially for all of the crazy stuff going on because of you have the different densities of air that the light's going through. So that's really not a problem anymore. Although I assume that they'll eventually have some of these lasers in space. But 100 megawatts, that's a lot. That's a powerful laser system, which we can now do. People will often say, oh, 100 megawatts, that's many thousands of households. You know, many thousands of households we use 100 megawatts altogether. But I converted that to, just to be goofy, I converted that 100 megawatts is equivalent to 134,000 horsepower or 95,000 BTUs per second. So just in case you needed those perspectives. Mm. But it's a lot. These are powerful lasers, of course, that you would need. Now, the payload in their plan would go into an elliptical medium Earth orbit. I never heard of a medium Earth orbit, but I guess we could say that's definitely not low Earth orbit. And so for sure, the conventional rockets will get the payload up there. So what happens then is the laser hits the reflector that's on the payload and directs it to the hydrogen heating tank, the hydrogen tank, which then creates temperatures of like 72,000 degrees Fahrenheit at its core. Now, the thrust, this surprised me, the thrust would last for almost an hour. Wow. of like, 58 minutes.
That's a lot.
Ramping that up for a whole hour? Whoa.
Yeah, that's going for, I'm not sure how much ramping up there is. I think it just,
going. Yeah,
actually, I don't know.
Maximum speed up for an hour and at that propulsion, adding to itself over the course of an hour?
Wow. How about this? It's when it finally is done lasing, the cargo's going at 17 kilometers per second. 17 kilometers per second.
And what's that equivalent?
How long did it take us to get to the moon in the 60s and early 70s? Three days?
A couple days.
Yeah. This would pass the moon in 8 hours.
Wow.
So this is booking.
Is this bad for people's, organs?
Yeah.
No, well, the acceleration wouldn't be deadly.
Okay.
It wouldn't be deadly.
You would not die. That's good.
No. I'm not sure.
Non-deadly acceleration is
non-deadly. It's non-deadly. Slightly non-deadly. But I know that the deceleration is not deadly. I know that for sure. I went through the paper. I didn't find any acceleration numbers.
Does it make you poop your pants?
Probably.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm shitting myself right here, Karen.
I know.
Now, of course, keeping the laser aligned with the craft is important, and apparently there's side thrusters which would keep the craft aligned with the laser beam as the Earth rotates. So that's important. The biggest problem then at this point is slowing down so the payload can get to Mars. Because the payload would be entering the Mars system, at like 16 kilometers per second. So there's a slight amount of slowing down. 16 kilometers per second. You're still booking pretty fast. So the problem is that you can't use a chemical rocket to slow down, right? Typically, you would like turn around, fire your chemical rocket, and then and then decelerate at a safe level. But you can't do that because that would kind of do away with the whole point of this. Because if you had the fuel to slow it down, then that would mean that your 1,000-kilogram payload would be about 60 kilograms. So you would lose most of your payload, a huge chunk of your payload. So that, and it just defeats the whole purpose of the challenge. So ideally, you would have another layer, another laser on Mars, and that laser would decelerate the craft.
The anti-laser.
Right, but that, right.
D-laser.
But that's, you know, we can't even talk about that because, you know, we need to like be on Mars and build another laser to do that. So that's not going to be in the cards for a little while.
Bob, could you use a mirror like to reflect the laser beam from Earth, then back at the back end of the rocket after it turns around?
Wait, what do you mean? From Earth to Mars?
So you get the lasers still on Earth. Right, and then when you need to slow down, the ship turns around, and then it deploys a mirror that will reflect the laser beam back, you know, so that you can decelerate.
I think something like that might be possible, but I don't think our lasers are up to that because you'd be mostly on your way to Mars. You'd be many.
So it's also the distance.
Yeah, distance. Of course, you've got laser beams are focused and coherent, but not forever. But Steve, they do have a plan apparently, because I think what they do is they jettison that heating unit with the hydrogen in it. They jettison that after the hour, and then they could use the laser to do what they call a back burn so that it can come back to the Earth. So they do have that. So it's reusable. But then, so what they do is it's all about aerobraking, right? That they decelerate the payload, using aerobraking techniques. Which has got to be tough because Mars's atmosphere is very, very thin. So that phase is going to be very difficult. They say that it's going to be about eight Gs of deceleration, which is nothing for most cargoes. And it's very doable for experienced humans. That's a lot. That's a lot of deceleration. And we can't really do, you know, much more acceleration or deceleration than 8 Gs, not for any extended period of times, of course. But it is doable. The bigger problem is the atmospheric friction. Even with the thin atmosphere of Mars, we actually do not have any like tiles that can withstand that. But the researchers or the engineers claim that they are under active development. That we will before too long have thermal tiles that can withstand that kind of deceleration at that velocity. So that's good. So now your question now might be, well, how feasible is this? Or is this just more Bob Novella pie in the sky baloney? My response is, first off, watch the attitude. And secondly, I will say that the paper focuses a lot on what it should in many ways.
The most
problematic components, specifically these critical subsystems like the heating chamber and the aero capture maneuver, the paper really takes a hard, long look at. And so this, and then their conclusion, they say this: the preliminary design of critical subsystems necessary for such a spacecraft has not found fundamental technological roadblocks to realize this propulsion system. That's the best news of this entire thing. There's no deal breakers that they identified with these really complex components and maneuvers. So that's fantastic. But of course, you know, let's wait till we get some peer review too, of course, because this is, I don't think it's been peer reviewed yet, not that I'm aware of. And if this does work, the stats, Steve, Jay, you know, we worked on rockets and propulsion and all sorts of stuff for the book. The stats are really impressive. Really impressive. So more than I would have imagined. So the mass to power ratio values that may be achieved. So this is a quote from the paper. The mass to power ratio values that may be achieved via laser thermal propulsion, 0.001 to 0.010 kilograms per kilowatt, are unparalleled. Unparalleled, far below even those cited for advanced nuclear propulsion technologies. Now, this is due to the fact, now, little callback, due to the fact that the power source remains on Earth and the delivered flux can be processed by low mass inflatable reflector. So yet again, we're seeing the benefits, the huge benefits of having the power source on the Earth or not on the ship. It's huge. And you've got this low mass inflatable reflector that can handle the flux, the laser flux. So those two things are giving this propulsion amazing stats. The specific impulse is 3,000 seconds, Steve, versus chemical.
That's huge. That's
huge. Chemical rockets have a specific impulse of 450 seconds. Now, a specific impulse is the total change to momentum or speed per unit of propellant mass. And they also tend to think of it as though as the time in seconds that the propellant or engine can accelerate its starting mass at 1G, blah, blah, blah. More seconds equals greater delta V. So just remember, specific impulse of 3,000 of seconds is fantastic. And there's other very tantalizing possibilities that this propulsion can do. And the paper addresses a little bit. Regarding cargo, we know that you can get more cargo using this method, right? They showed a potential tenfold increase in payload capacity compared to the common Centaur cryogenic upper stage. Tenfold order of magnitude increase in payload. That's like a sea change. That's huge. That's a milestone if they could really do it. They also say that this architecture is suitable for some things that conventional chemical rockets or even solar electric propulsion is unsuitable for. Like, for example, rapid missions to the outer ice giants. We can't do that with conventional rockets. This can do that, apparently. How about into the interstellar medium? You know, you could use rockets like this to join the Twin Voyagers, you know, quicker than any other way to get there, it seems. Steve, you're like this one. We could use this to intercept interstellar objects passing through the solar system.
Mm, yeah.
Right?
Wow.
We could actually intercept them using this. This idea of, right, and I got this. This is from our research from our book, The Skeptic's Guide to the Future, that was submitted today to the publisher.
That's right.
Basically, so we're very, very happy. Woo. So this is from my research. So this whole idea of directed energy, not on a hydrogen heating unit, but a solar sail, a light sail, I think is going to be the ultimate expression of this type of technology using directed energy. I mean, that actually might be the fastest propulsion technology that could ever exist. If you extrapolate what could be possible by using teams of like megawatt, gigawatt, terawatt, petawatt, exawatt, yadawatt, whatever, go keep mounting the decimals using super powerful lasers that are set up at various locations, like say from the sun and then from Mars and then from, you know, and then from the asteroid, whatever. And you could actually get up to like not just relativistic speeds, but ultra relativistic speeds. If you travel long enough and use powerful enough lasers, you can get crazy velocities that you might not be able to get up to with any other technology that we can conceive, even antimatter engines.
And matter won't fly apart at those speeds, right?
Because, I mean, it certainly can if you accelerate too fast or if you hit stuff in space.
Well, there's that too.
What about if you just hit space?
No, not just okay, hitting space good. Itself.
It ain't like dusting crops, boy.
So this directed energy propulsion, and you'll read about this, I hope you'll read about it in the book, you could potentially go ultra-relativistic. 99% the speed of light is feasible, potentially feasible using this technology that no other technology could ever do. So that's what we're talking about here. This is a form, it's a variant of what may be the ultimate form of propulsion in the universe, no matter how advanced or how smart you are. I'm just throwing that out there. And it's fascinating stuff. Read more about it in our book at some point in the future, near future.
And that was your quickie with Bob.
Yeah, in the near term, Bob, and this may be like the first use of this kind of technology would be just sending probes to the outer solar system, right? It doesn't have to come back. We just have to accelerate it going out.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
you don't need the probe to come back, but it would get there instead of, we'll be out there, you know, in 12 years, it'll get there much quicker.
Oh, yeah. And they're even talking about using like these little nano-sized probes, I guess, that are super light and that you accelerate, with lasers and getting to, you know, Proxima Centauri, Alpha Centauri in like 20 years. I mean,
exactly.
That's just like within someone's lifetime, we could have data coming back from Proxima, the Alpha Centauri system. That's amazing. And that's something that I'll never see.
All right, Kara, tell us how chimpanzees self-medicate.
Yeah, so a cool study was just published literally 2 days ago as of this recording in Current Biology magazine. some researchers, I think they're mostly German researchers, but working out of West Africa, made some observations over the past couple of years of chimpanzees applying insects to both their wounds and to the wounds of other chimpanzees. Yeah, so this is really cool. Nobody had ever seen... So individuals had observed behavior of self-medicating in the animal kingdom over several years. We've seen it happen with bears, with elephants, with moths, with certain birds, and we've seen it in great apes. But usually... it would either be like eating plant parts to maybe settle their stomach, which is associated with potentially eating some sort of, quote, medicine to fight against an intestinal parasite, or sometimes applying something topically, but more like leaves or soil or, you know, liquid or something like that.
Rub some dirt on it.
Yeah, just rub some dirt in it. But we've never actually observed, apparently, insects as a topical medication in great apes. And so these researchers documented 19 examples of individuals applying insects to their own wounds, and then 3 examples of individuals applying insects to the wounds of conspecifics, so of individuals within their group. It's super interesting because they all followed pretty much the same course. They would catch a flying insect, put it in their mouth to immobilize it. So I'm not sure if they're actually killing it or if they're just weighing down the wings or maybe crushing the wings, but they put it in between their lips and then they rub it against the wound or into the wound of either themselves or another chimp, oftentimes putting it back in their mouth multiple times and reapplying it. So over and over and over, rub in the wound, put it in their mouth, rub it in the wound, put it in their mouth, and then usually discarding the insect. So they're not eating the insect and they're not leaving the insect in the wound. They're applying it to the wound.
No.
Is it maybe just a saliva delivery system?
But why not just lick their finger?
Yeah.
You know, why go to the...
It's like a bandage, but they don't leave any part of the insect there.
They don't leave... they don't know, right? So here's the thing that we have to remember. These were observational from a distance. So A, these researchers have not had a chance to inspect the wounds. They have not had a chance to see if this, quote, self-medication actually does accelerate healing. And they have not even had a chance to identify the species of insect to know if it has any medicinal properties.
Oh, okay.
Right. Because they're watching from a distance. These organisms are existing in nature. And so they're watching them. They're recording it. There's actual video online. You can go to like YouTube and see video of this happening. It's very cool. And they're saying, yes, what we want to do now is we want to compare those who self-medicate with insects to those who allow their wounds to heal on their own. We also want to see if we can't find these insects. They know it's a winged insect. They know that they're catching it usually beneath a branch or a leaf. They know that they're less than 5 millimeters and usually dark in color, and that they're not actually swallowing the insects. They were able to observe all of that from the distance, but they don't yet know if that insect has, you know, any medicinal properties, or if this is a trial and error thing, or, you know, really what it represents. But based on the fact that it's such a specific incidence, that in every single one of these cases, there was an open wound, and either they themselves caught the winged insect and put it in their wound over and over, or did it to somebody else, they are asserting that, yes, this is an example of medication. And even beyond self-medication, this could be an example of pro-social behavior, which is kind of...
Which we know chimps have.
Which we know chimps have, but apparently there's a lot of controversy in that area. Like, we've seen them do things like cooperative hunting. We've seen them do cooperative guarding behaviors. But yeah, there's apparently a lot of controversy, especially in the way that we describe pro-social behavior as requiring empathy. You know, Franz de Waal, as we know, has like really put forth these ideas, but there are still a lot of researchers who are like, no, that's not what's happening. This is, you know, this kind of instinctual behavior, and it doesn't really, they might be cooperative, but they're not actually doing it for the benefit of their neighbor. Like, they're still doing it for some sort of like selfish gain. And so it's an interesting observational study that obviously lends itself to more in-depth research. Obviously, most of this is, quote, like discussion section stuff. Like, is this what's actually happening? But it's definitely contributing to this field that's where there's a lot of controversy already.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, very cool. But you're right. Like, we kind of make both kinds of mistakes. We underestimate what animals can do, but we also then read too much into their behaviors.
Totally.
And so we have to make sure that we're really careful here. you know, and but there's a biological component to this, so that can be investigated very objectively, you know.
Absolutely. And we've seen examples of chimpanzees already self-medicating. This is just a different application, potentially.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Any guesses, guys?
I don't have a clue.
Some parts of it sound like a rocket taking off, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but why the stop and the restart and, you know, that it's like breaks
like
up.
A,
I don't know.
A rain sticky vibe, but.
Well, let's see what the listeners think. So we have a listener named Brendan. He said, "Hi, Jay, everyone. I initially thought the noisy this week was the sound going through Jay's head as he bites into a particularly good meatball. But I've since ruled that out. I'm not sure if it's profound enough. So my guess for this week's noisy is a nuclear bomb test."
I
thought that was a very good guess. That is incorrect. You'll see what it actually is very soon. But, you know, I guess the thing that it actually is in a nuclear bomb test or probably have some things in common from a sound perspective. Kristen McConnell wrote in, "Hey, Jay, I believe this week's noisy is a controlled avalanche. I can hear the explosion, then the snow loosening up and falling. Love the show. Thanks, Kristen." I have heard this. I have been at a ski resort when this was happening.
Didn't we talk about avalanche guns at some point recently?
Yeah, we did. Yep. Yeah, there's similarities between that and what it is. This is not a correct guess, but definitely a good guess. A listener named Richard Smith wrote in and said, "This week's noisy sounds like the lightning and detonation of a sizable quantity of thermite on top of ice." Ooh. I don't think I've ever heard that. I don't hear an ice sound in there either, but I don't know. I don't claim to be an expert with thermite. That is not a correct guess. We have another guess here by Patrick McComb. He said, I'm guessing that is the prepping, launching, and detonating of a torpedo, and I am almost certainly incorrect. I thought he was going to say correct. I can't remember if I've heard a recording of a torpedo being shot. I bet you it sounds very different depending on the sub that you're in as well. That is not correct. And this week there were no winners. Yeah. I thought this one was going to be much easier. So this was sent in by a listener named John McNeil. And he said, "Seeing this video is really cool. This is actually a very cool video. There is a mechanical spring release that you hear, and it separates the spacecraft following a silent pause and then probably a recognizable sound of a rocket motor as the payload moves on to orbit." So now I went to the YouTube video and I read more about this. This was posted by Rocket Lab. So what we're hearing is first and second stage separation of Rocket Lab's Electron launch vehicle during the return to sender mission on November 20th, 2020. So what's happening is the second stage is preparing to disconnect from the first stage rocket. And there's you hear like a latch type of sound. And that's like a mechanism. I guess it's decoupling. And then there's a massive pressure change. And then it is expelled from the first stage. And then the rocket boosters come on. So let me play it for you one more time. That's depressurization. There's the latch. That's the second stage being ejected. Now listen to the rockets.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's it rocketing away. Very, very cool. I recommend you go to Rocket Lab and check out Electron Launch Vehicle Separation. Very, very, very cool video. And when you realize that you're in outer space when the whole thing is happening, because you don't know that you're in outer space until the mechanism separates, it's pretty cool. It's a very cool video. Check it out. All right, guys, I have a new noisy for you this week.
Wait, but before you go on, basically I was correct.
You are, Steve. I wasn't going to tell you before.
Make sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, of course, yeah.
So Steve's the winner.
Steve has won everything this week, guys. It is, today's the 9th, and Steve has won. So, okay, Mika Heinonen.
Micah, maybe.
Mika? It's either Mika or Micah. Well, how's it spelled? M-I-K-A or M-I-C-A?
M-I-C-H-A.
It's M-I-I-K-K-A.
It's probably
what?
Mika.
Two I's?
Okay, Mika Heininen. Yeah. Heininen. Okay. Mika has sent in a very cool noisy for you guys this week. And here it is. I want you to tell me. I'm just going to give it to you. Tell me what animal this is.
Hello.
Dad.
Hello. What?
Sounds right. Bovinian.
So to the SGU listeners, please don't email me and that you know a human talk. I'm not talking about the humans, of course. There is a low sound in that audio that I played you that I want you to identify.
All right, just the low sound.
Just tell me what animal it is. That's what I want. You can send me your answer to WTN@theskepticsguide.org, and also don't forget to send me any noises that you heard this week. Steve, we have 4 shows on the books and a 5th one to be queued up and announced next week. The 4 shows that we have are an extravaganza and a private SGU recording in New York City, and an extravaganza and another private SGU recording in Boston. These are happening the weekend of March 25th. If you go to theskepticsguide.org/events, you will see the 4 shows listed there. And by the time you go, you might even see that 5th show that will be listed there, which is going to be in Bethlehem, PA. So please join us, guys. This is a great way for you to show your support to the SGU. It's an incredible amount of fun. We had people, when we went to Denver, we did 3 shows in Colorado, 2 in Denver and 1 in Fort Collins. And we had people, a lot of people come to all 3 of those shows. And it was unbelievable to talk to people that did that. So anyway, show your support. Come on out. We'd love to see you.
All right. Thanks, Jay. All right. We're going to do 1 email. This one comes from William from Atlanta. And he writes, my question is, without genetic material from a lot of specimens of a species to create individuals from, is any level of de-extinction possible at all? What I mean by that is, say we are able to create a mammoth or 2, 1 male, 1 female, and they are able to breed successfully. Isn't this already creating an insurmountable genetic bottleneck? The genetic diversity of breeding the offspring to those initial 2 together could probably lead to terrible consequences. Do you think it would be possible to use gene editing to increase the genetic diversity of an attempt at de-extinction? Or if we used modern elephant DNA in the place of Jurassic Park's frog DNA, could we create a genetically stable series of hybrid mammoth? It's a hybrid. He wrote that.
Finally, it's a hybrid.
Yeah. In a side note, there are only 1,864 giant pandas in the world today. Is even that number enough to ensure the genetic diversity needed for a stable population, considering that they are territorial and may not be mixing genes very well in the wild? A lot to unpack there. Let me pull out a couple of things. So the basic idea that a genetic bottleneck is a risk of extinction is correct. If, you know, historically speaking, if a species goes through a genetic bottleneck, and 2,000 seems to be like the magic number, where you have less than 2,000 individuals, the risk of extinction over the next, say, 1,000 years goes way up. It's not a guarantee, it's just a probability. And there's a number of reasons for that. Genetic diversity within a population is a hedge against extinction because it means that some individuals are going to be resistant to certain infections or maybe more adaptable to drought conditions or whatever. And when a stress hits, there's more likely to be some individuals who are going to be able to deal with that stress. Whereas if you have a loss of genetic diversity, just the probability of one virus wiping out the whole population goes way up. And so just as statistically speaking, it's a huge risk of extinction.
You also do sometimes see not just like ability to protect against infection, but when the bottleneck happens, you will sometimes see genetic anomalies spread like wildfire through the population because the population's so small. Like a perfect example is the Florida panther. Like they were on the brink and they had all sorts of terrible consequences because their habitat range was really, really narrowed. And it's happening in California to our panther species or to our panther individuals. Which is why connection, obviously, is so important. Because it can happen even if a species isn't going extinct, if it just gets, you know, stuck and isn't able to outbreed.
Yeah, but it's not guaranteed. It's not guaranteed.
Of course not.
There's lots of instances evolutionarily when a very small group of individuals must have started a speciation event. So at some point, you know, the possibility of starting a successful population with one male and two females, just three individuals, is about 50%. So it's totally possible to go through a bottleneck like that and survive at the other side. But it's just a really super high risk that you're, you know, something could wipe you out. But there's a couple of, I think, misconceptions in here. So having offspring with close kin is not as bad as these making it out to be. It kind of depends on the genetic diversity and health of the population to begin with. But like cousins having children, it's actually not a bad thing evolutionarily or genetically. It does increase the risk of, you know, of recessive genes lining up, but not that much. And in fact, if you have beneficial traits, you know, it's actually a good thing, you know, in terms of spreading the beneficial traits within a population. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. Plus, if we were able to de-extinct, let's say, two mammoths, they wouldn't necessarily be related, right? They could, right. Those two mammoths could have a lot of genetic diversity. They might be 3,000 years apart in terms of
right.
when that DNA was around. But of course, the more different they are, the better, because then, you know, the chances of mixing any recessive traits, et cetera, goes down, and the diversity within their offspring goes way down.
But even if they're related, even if like two organisms are directly related, mother or son, brother, sister, it's not a guarantee that their offspring is going to be like, you know, have flippers. Like,
yeah, it's not like it's going to be a horrible mutant. It's just the risk of a genetic disease goes up. That's basically it. And, you know, that's something in medicine that, you know, especially depending on the population, we have to ask about consanguinity, you know, any parents closely related, because then we know that we may have to look harder for certain genetic diseases. But it's not like you can necessarily tell just by looking at them or their overall health. They could be otherwise perfectly healthy. The idea of a mammoth-elephant hybrid has been raised by scientists who are involved in this de-extinction, program with the mammoth. That may be one of the viable ways that we can do it. Like, for example, if not just for the genetic diversity, but also just to make it happen at all. So let's say you get the full DNA of a mammoth. What do you do at that point? One thing you could do is use it to clone that mammoth and birth it in an elephant. But you can also, you know, basically cross that DNA with an elephant, and you inseminate the elephant with the DNA. You don't clone the DNA, and then you get a hybrid, and that's just much more likely to be a successful organism. Right.
Maybe. I mean, we don't know that, though.
Well, that's the idea. That the idea right. is your chance of success is going to go way up than trying to do a full clone. And then if you do that even a couple of times, like you take the hybrid mammoth elephant and then you inseminate that with mammoth DNA, then you get a 3/4 mammoth and then a 7/8, you know, mammoth, whatever. And it just keeps going up. And until you basically have a mammoth, you know, with a little bit of elephant DNA in it.
How similar is a woolly mammoth genetically to an African elephant? Like, would mom? Is there not a potential that mom would just spontaneously abort because this?
No, I think they're close
DNA
enough.
DNA's too different.
It would be okay.
Oh,
no, okay. No. As long as there's like the chromosomes line up, you're probably okay.
Do they? Do we know that they do?
Well, they were talking about doing it, so I'm assuming that they do.
Yeah, I didn't know that they were talking about doing it that way. I always thought it was more like the Jurassic Park. Like, we're just gonna fix any holes that we have in the sequence.
No, that's the serious plan, is to do a mammoth elephant hybrid. That might be the first, if anyone successfully does it, that might be the first thing that we see.
Do it.
Right.
But I mean, we know how to clone. Like, it's not like we haven't done it successfully multiple
times.
That's
true, but we haven't cloned a huge mammal from ancient reconstructed DNA.
True.
Cloning is still tricky, you know, and it's not a perfected technology. It's a successful technology, but it's still very, very tricky. So this would be one way just to give a higher probability of success by doing the hybrid rather than the full clone. But we'll see. We'll see where this goes. I mean, we basically have the mammoth DNA, you know. I don't know what the best shape it's in, but they're still working with it. So yeah, there's a lot of potential gotchas in here. And again, the technology is tricky, but it's plausible. It is totally plausible that we could, you know, de-extinct in this way. And if we can get it to work once, we can get it to work multiple times. I mean, we have DNA, not necessarily fully functional genomes. We have DNA from woolly mammoths over a million year period. I mean, talk about genetic diversity, you know. They're probably not the same exact species either, but they're like, you know, probably cousins themselves.
Closer than a mammoth and an elephant.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So
maybe.
Yeah, so multiple specimens may be the way we get to a good genetically diverse population. The other thing is, you know, you talk about like the risk of extinction in a small population. That's true, but it's that data is based upon populations in the wild. If they're in captivity and we are nursing the hell out of them, it's not the same risk. Mm. You know, we can keep that small population going and allow genetic diversity to build up over time, you know, through spontaneous mutations, et cetera. The idea of using genetic bioengineering in order to deliberately increase genetic diversity is interesting. Ooh. That's an interesting idea, but we'd have to know what we're doing. Like, what are we?
No, we wouldn't.
random mutations, or we know what we're trying to make the genes into? I don't know.
Right. Do we already know about mammoth diseases that we're now going to try to prevent? Like, these are extinct animals.
Yeah. I mean, so it's not a terrible idea conceptually, but in practice, it may prove very, very challenging. Let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Just three regular news items this week. Are you guys ready? All right, here we go. Item number one, a new CT scanning technology uses the low end of the gamma ray spectrum rather than X-rays to form images with over 10 times the resolution. Item number two, engineers have made a robot that can morph from one shape to another through liquid metal, yet hold either shape with a rigid structure. And item number three, scientists have discovered the first known metal alloy that does not soften as it is heated through a wide range of temperature above 1,000 Kelvin. Who's due to go first? Who hasn't gone first in a while? I think Bob hasn't gone first in a while.
No!
Bob, go first.
Yay!
I refuse. Where do you get this? All right, so I'm got to go through this. CT scanning technology, the low end of the gamma ray spectrum? What? Gamma rays? Come on. They go through lead. How the hell are you going to focus, you're going to deal with the gamma rays, and how are you going to create them? I don't know, man. I mean, I don't know a lot of details of how that would work, but man, that's just, you're just totally trying to make me lose it on that one, I think. All right. So that too, we got a robot that can morph from one shape to another through liquid metal. Yet hold her shape from one shape to another through liquid metal.
Yeah. Terminator 2.
Yeah. Of course, the first thing I thought too. I was looking at tons of news sites. I didn't see any of this crap. All right, so now we got a first known metal alloy that does not soften as it's heated through a wide temperature range above 1,000 K. Yeah, I mean, okay. See, that one doesn't sound too egregious, and that probably means that might be the fiction, bastard. I don't know. Go to somebody else.
Doesn't work that way.
Let's do the robot morph one. Say that's fiction. You better say something good about that gamma ray crap.
Okay, Kara.
I'm not with Bob, but I'm with where Bob was gonna go. I think gamma ray CT computerized tomography. I don't understand this. I could see using gamma rays for like medicine, like for zapping cancer or something like that, but not for imaging. It would just be the risk would outweigh the benefit, and we have really good imaging. I mean, we're always trying to improve our imaging, but
so
most of the time. Right. Most of the time when we're trying to improve our imaging, it's to see smaller and smaller tumors. What we don't want to do is induce carcinogenesis while we're doing that. So to me, this one feels like the fiction. I'm just going to say that out on top. The other two I don't really get. So I'm going to stick with those being science.
Yeah. What's throwing me is this low end of gamma ray spectrum. Well, right, okay. I'm not too familiar with the low end of that spectrum.
Is it like 1 nanometer away from not being a gamma ray? I don't know. But yeah.
Sure. Why not? I mean, It's a judgment, kind of a judgment call. Not necessarily. Well, I'll stop.
But I'm going to assume it's still a gamma ray, damn it.
It's in the gamma ray spectrum. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Evan.
Well, yeah. And Bob, I thought you were going to definitely go with this gamma ray one.
It's too obvious, and I know that's exactly what he's hoping.
Gamma ray destroys things, doesn't it? And yeah, low end, but it's still like the extreme side of the low end, right? You're still at definitely one end of that spectrum, certainly more towards the middle. Rather than x-rays for 10 times the resolution, I mean, and Kara, did you say, don't we already have things that can give you the resolution at better than x-rays? And this just doesn't really add up. Whereas the other two, again, I don't have
in other words, idea. Evan, it's a CT scanner that has 10 times the resolution of a regular CT scanner. That
of
uses
the
X-rays.
CT scanner. Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right, a new CT scanning technology. CT scans use x-rays.
Yeah.
I mean,
yes, right. I understand that.
The resolution makes sense because gamma rays have the highest frequency, so okay.
But they also that damage, don't they? The liquid metal ones does sound fascinating. You know, T2, I mean, definitely. How can you not think of that? I'll go with Kara. I think it's the gamma ray one fiction.
And Jay. I am definitely going with Bob.
Yay!
Strongly don't think that there is any liquid metal robot nothing. I don't agree.
All right, so you all agree with the third one.
Damn it.
So I'll start there. Scientists have discovered the first known metal alloy that does not soften as it is heated through a wide temperature range above 1,000 Kelvin. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. This one's very cool, actually. This is a lot cooler than it may at first sound. So the alloy
there?
Is Elenvar. Elenvar sounds like a Middle Earth fantasy.
Yeah,
it's a super elastic, high entropy Elenvar alloy. And imagine the use of this. You have a metal that doesn't get soft when it gets heated through a massive temperature range. This is perfect for aerospace engineering.
Yeah,
right? You want to build your opposite of this.
Definitely.
Yeah, so normally when you heat up a metal, it expands, and that expansion, right, there's thermal expansion. And the thermal expansion makes it soft, right? This is why the Twin Towers collapsed.
Yeah, exactly.
The steel heated up. It lost its strength.
It didn't melt, but it got weak.
It didn't melt, but it got soft and collapsed. So that's what happens. This is the first alloy where that is not the case, where because of this special lattice structure that it has, it doesn't experience that. In fact, it gets a little bit stiffer when it heats up, a tiny bit. So if it's moving in the other direction.
Is it light?
That's wicked.
Or is it like super heavy metal?
It's metal. I mean,
but there's like carbon fiber and then there's
it's
like,
not super light. That's
steel.
That's not its feature. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
It didn't tell
not
me.
Not going to make body armor out of it, I guess.
Well, but I mean, we're talking about aerospace. Like,
can it be
want,
used
like,
for aerospace?
Heavy metals.
Well, that's what they're selling it as. That this would be a perfect, alloy for aerospace. So I'm assuming it's not horribly heavy.
Right.
Iron Man.
Or expensive or anything else. Damn, man. Cool.
It has stiffness. So even when heated to 1,000 K, it has stiffness comparable to that at room temperature. It expands without any notable phase transition.
Right, hey, Siri.
We talked about phase transitions a couple weeks ago, I think.
What's 1,000 Kelvin in Fahrenheit?
It's 726 degrees Celsius.
1,000 Kelvins is equivalent to about 1,340 degrees Fahrenheit.
1340 okay. Fahrenheit.
Wait, why is your Siri British?
I like it, all right?
No, I mean, I dig it too. I didn't know you could do that.
Oh, yeah, it's cool.
Mine's Scottish.
1340 Fahrenheit. That's
so I can't understand
man.
It.
Yeah.
Then what happens? Above that, then I guess it does say, oh, screw it, and gets soft.
Yeah, eventually, everything has a melting point,
I don't want to go to
even
the
magnesium,
sun.
Right?
All right, let's go back to number one. A new CT scanning technology uses the low end of the gamma ray spectrum rather than x-rays to form images with over 10 times the resolution. So Evan and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Jay, you think this one is the science. This one is science. So, I'm saying you think this is science.
Nice try, Bob.
You know that x-rays and gamma rays are right next to each other. So there is one point at which you tick over from x-rays to gamma rays.
Yeah.
X-rays, if you get enough of them, that increases your cancer risk as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
So this is not necessarily a qualitative difference in going from x-rays to gamma rays.
But it would need to be far enough from the x-ray to get 10 times the resolution, which I think is far enough from the x-ray to also get 10 times the radiation, which is bad.
Yeah. Well, I have no idea because I just made this up.
Yes!
Yeah, gamma rays, no. We're not going to be shooting gamma rays through people if we're trying to kill tissue.
But maybe as a treatment, maybe.
Yeah, it's used to kill cancer cells.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Totally. Gamma knife.
Nuclear medicine, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, you can target it, sure.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
You can, with a little laser.
And eventually when we create gamma ray lasers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are we going to finish that thought?
But do I have to?
We put like little radiation pellets into cancer, and yeah, we target, we do proton beams and things like that with cancer, right?
Steve, yeah. I hate you.
I know. I got to mix it up, right? I got to throw in ones that are obviously false just so that you think.
Just to screw me. I know it. I know it.
All right. All this means that engineers have made a robot that can morph from one shape to another through liquid metal, yet hold either shape with a rigid structure.
That's very cool.
It's probably
very
tiny.
Cool science.
Whatever.
The name of the article, Shape Morphing Mechanical Metamaterials Through Reversible Plasticity.
Yeah, how have you not read this article, Bob?
Yeah, Bob.
Oh, man. Don't know.
It's happening, Bob.
Like a Google alert for that.
It was on the front page of Plasticity Today.
And a metamaterial. Wait, what did you say about metamaterial?
This is the title of the article, Shape Morphing Mechanical Metamaterials Through Reversible Plasticity, published in Science Robotics.
Oh, I did read that.
It's really cool. So they say that they coupled an elastomeric kirigami. So kirigami is like origami, you know what I mean? It's something you can fold it to make it change its shape, right? And they made it out of an elastic rubber-like material, but inside was a metal to give it a rigid frame. But this is a metal with a very low melting point. Mm. And so they could liquefy it just by heating it up a little bit. Have the kirigami go through the morphic shape change into another configuration, and then they cool the metal back into a rigid structure again.
I see. So there's still a scaffolding that's changing shape. Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah, it's liquid
that's
for the
cool.
change, but then it's solid on either side. And then because it's this, you know how you have the metamaterial that could change, it could fold from one configuration to another. So there's two stable configurations. So then it could go back again, right? So like the example they give is you could have, and this is what they're developing, right? They have essentially a robot, a droid, a soft robot that morphs from a car to a drone, right? So it's in one configuration, it's made for driving on the road, and then it changes configuration in order to become a drone. And then
it's a transformer.
It's a transformer.
That's so cool.
A robot in disguise.
Talk to me when it turns from a car into a suitcase.
Robot. 5 to 10 years.
A suitcase.
Have you seen the little kids who have the Transformer costumes for Halloween?
Yes, and
yes,
they're epic.
But they're great.
And they fold themselves up and become cars.
I can't believe
epic.
How well that works. It blows my mind.
It's so good.
Cool. Oh, well, wish I had. Kara, at yes. Dragon Con, there was a couple of people in adults in huge Transformer costumes.
That's pretty cool.
That would fold up, you know, that would transform. They were amazing.
Yeah, some of the best costumes I've ever seen.
Ugh, so cool.
So much talent there.
Yeah, absolutely. Now they could do it with this metamaterial liquid metal, elastomeric kirigami. Very cool. Very cool. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
This quote comes from a listener, someone who emailed us recently. And I'll read to you a line from the email, and then I'll give you the quote. I wanted to share a quote with the skeptics that I've used more internally than out loud over the last 20 years or so. This quote may, in fact, be attributable to me personally, as I have not found anyone else that it has been attributed to. Here's the quote. I strive to be a lifelong learner, and I have never learned anything by being correct.
Huh.
His name is Dr. R. I don't know his first name. Dr. R. Schulze, or Schulz.
Schulze.
S-H-U-L-Z-E. And here's the first line of his email title to us was longtime listener, old acquaintance of Perry's from California. He says he's been a listener for quite some time. Your podcast showed up on our radar during an attempt to find Perry many years ago. Unfortunately, he had passed shortly before we discovered it. And he's part of the West Coast cadre of friends that Perry had, gamers that he used to be with, including some other people that we know.
Yeah.
And that's great. So he went looking for Perry, found the podcast. Unfortunately, Perry had passed, but he became a regular listener of the show and decided to reach out to us and with a very lovely email. So thank you, Dr. Schulz.
All right. Well, thanks, Evan. That's pretty cool. Always fun to have a connection to Perry as well. Perry lived out in California for about a year, and he made a lot of friends out there. We still hear from them occasionally.
We do, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's remarkable.
You know who else he met out there?
Who?
Phil Hudson.
Hudson was one of those people in that gamer group, correct? And Dr. Schultz mentioned that in the email as well.
Phil Hudson worked with us on some of our video projects like Ock, the Skeptical Caveman. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Yeah,
thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.